Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Haynes Johnson, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, best-selling author, and television commentator. He's author of numerous bestsellers and has just published The Age of Anxiety, McCarthyism to Terrorism. Haynes, welcome back to Berkeley.
Well, thanks, Harry. I love being here with you.
Let's talk a little about the origins of this book. When did you conceive this book? Because we're meeting today on the day in which the special prosecutor is announcing indictments, and here you have this book to give us background to an earlier period where we went through traumas.
It really began, the genesis of this was actually 9/11. Because, again, a climate of terror and fear enveloped the country. Legitimate fear. We were attacked. And then I watched it begin to unfold, great unity in the country, and suddenly the echoes of the Cold War kept creeping in the manipulation of the press, in the disunity, in charges of smears on people who are not loyal and so forth. And that took me back to the McCarthy period, the Cold War, when I was a young student, young officer in the Army during the Korean War, and all that. And I always thought I'd go back to that at some day, but the genesis was, again, a playing up of fear and how fear can be exploited for political purposes. And that seems to me the enduring lesson, linking past and present to this very moment that we're speaking.
And how did you go? Was it a difficult book to research? A lot had been written,
yes.
But you indicate that a lot of the McCarthy files are still sealed.
Well, I'm frustrated. Anybody would be, or scholars would be. There's at the archives of Marquette University, his widow, Jean, left the McCarthy papers, all 25 huge installments of the papers. Half of those are sealed. And she said they could not be printed, used or opened in her lifetime. And in the lifetime of a child they had adopted 3 weeks before he died, she's still alive. The widow is long dead. You can't get to them. And the sealed part is what I would love to see. The financial records, the medical records, the real private correspondence, the office logs, all of these things in there. However, there was enough material in those files. And also in the Wisconsin Historical Society, where I did research as a graduate student in American history, a wonderful treasure of that. And there's a great archive in Washington that not many people use too much. It's the United States Senate Historical Office. They have these oral histories, and they are fascinating because they've gone back and interviewed not just the senators and so forth, they've interviewed the people on the staffs who really worked and saw. And this is after the fact, very candid, and I use those. And then I was around as a young person, as a young reporter and so forth, so I remembered all these things too. And it was a long process, a 4-year project really.
Mm-hmm. You work at the intersection of history and journalism.
Yes.
And this book very much reminds me of the work of Frederick Lewis Allen, sort of contemporary history. Tell us about the particular problems that arise when you're trying to relate to current events and still going back into history.
Well, Frederick Lewis Allen is one of my mentors, heroes, models, or whatever you want to say. I mean, I love what he did Only Yesterday, Since Yesterday, on the 1920s, 1930s. And I've tried to sort of do those in social histories of the 80s and the 90s and all that. There is a problem in that you can really reach the whole problem, and all of a sudden it changes before you finish your story.
Mm-hmm.
You can work for years, and all of a sudden you have it out, and maybe it doesn't seem to be as pertinent, or some new information comes that changes it around. So you don't have the leisure of stepping back 40, 50 years with all the documentation. But in this story, it's a narrative history of 50 years of American life.
Mm-hmm.
So the actual soundings on the Cold War, the bomb, McCarthyism, the wars that we led us into, all that really is history. So the question of trying to recreate that with documentation and bring it up to the present. The present is more difficult because it's happening even as we speak. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I never would have anticipated this. It seems more pertinent now than when I began.
That's right.
So in that sense, it's a sad commentary, but the links. And I, in the end of the book, I do talk a great deal about the links and the parallels between now and then. But they are literally, as you said, right at this moment, they couldn't be more pertinent.
Right. And I should tell our audience that we're meeting today.
Yes.
When the indictments by the special prosecutor have been announced. So we will get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
But there's also a family connection here, because your family experienced McCarthyism. And we should tell our audience that your father was a journalist, and he also won the Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
So we have a father-son Pulitzer Prize-winning family here. But he was affected, and your father's family was affected.
Yes, very much. That's always been. I was in high school in New York City in 1948 when he's writing Crime on the Waterfront, article series exposing the reign of terror and murder on the waterfront by a corrupt union that mob controlled. They were murdering people. And he named Albert Anastasia and Lucky Luciano and Frank Costello, and it led to the later on the Kefauver hearings, and so we got a lot of calls threatening us at home by the mobsters. That was one thing, but also the day the articles began, the union president Joseph Ryan, who later went to jail because of the revelations in my father's article, started attacking my father as a communist. The articles were pro-communist. It was pro-communist propaganda to defame and destroy good working people, when in fact the whole idea was an expose to help the working people free themselves of murder and exploitation on the docks. But that, he sold the rights to Hollywood, and then for 5 years.
That is your father selling the rights.
The rights, became the movie On the Waterfront.
And
so for 5 years, there was this incredible attack on my father. This was a communist-inspired document, and we hired Bud Schulberg, the writer, who had been a young communist in the 30s. He had long since left the party by the time the movie came out in 1955, but it was based on a screenwriter, a commie, and my father's work, a commie, so that was it, and they tried to get my father fired. And so that was when Joe McCarthy was reigning supreme. So I remember McCarthyism. By then, I had finished undergraduate work, and I was in the United States Army. And I remember vividly what it was like to be in the Army during the Korean War, when the Army McCarthy televised hearings took place. And I remember how morale sank inside the uniformed services, the idea that we were supposed to be infested by communist traitors and led by communists, and people who had meddled and bled in three wars, the United States, were nothing but subversives. It was a terrible... So I remember that.
You mentioned a letter that your father wrote to your mother, which you discovered after his death, describing a family dinner where, and this would be in the late 40s when Truman had announced the Truman Doctrine. Because what I think is important for our audience is that McCarthy fits into a historical context where we were worried about the communists and about the Soviet. But you made a crack when you had a remarkable insight for a 16-year-old, and tell us what that was dinner table.
It was a breakfast the morning after Truman's speech, the Truman Doctrine. We will fight communism wherever it appears in the world and stop it. And that began really the Cold War period. And my father wrote my mother and said, Hainsey, he called me Hainsey, he said, he can be pretty smart, as you know, and he put his finger on it at breakfast this morning. He said that about Truman's speech. That means we'll have to have a standing army all over the world, and that means we'll have to go to places like the Middle East. I don't see the future in going to the Middle East for me. And I said in the footnote, my father, if it makes me seem as I was 15, about to be 16 at the time, and it makes me seem wise and so forth. The fact is, in the same letter, he said, I wish our Haynes wasn't such a blunderbuss. He's booking another pair of glasses and so forth. But that was the... Totally didn't even know about that letter until I found it long after they had died in this research for them.
So let's help our audience get a handle on this subject. Who was Joseph McCarthy, and how long did this thing, this phenomenon that he created, McCarthyism, last? What are the yeah. the bookmarks here?
Joe McCarthy was a United States Senator from Wisconsin. Poor boy, grew up in a rural area, one of nine children, in Appleton, north of Appleton, Wisconsin. Terribly ambitious, hungry, wanted to, the classic American story, wanted to make something of himself, worked his way through college, actually dropped out of high school, founded and had a whole series of events, and finished high school and 1 year later at the age of 21, goes on to Marquette, becomes a lawyer, starts out, always wanted to be, he told people from the beginning, I want to be the first Catholic president of the United States. This is a long, long time ago, way before the Kennedys and so forth. And he then became a lawyer. He was elected a judge, and he was then a Democrat, a militant, a New Dealer, and so forth, which he later defamed. He left the party not out of ideology, but the Republicans offered a better opportunity. He goes in the war as a Marine Corps officer in the Pacific, and he starts falsifying his military record, claims himself to be Tail Gunner Joe. He was an intelligence officer. He would brief the pilots when they came back at Bougainville or Guadalcanal or whatever on the mission, but occasionally they let him go up and fly a mission, but he wasn't so much in danger. And he started claiming and sending articles back to Wisconsin about Tail Gunner Joe. He flew 17 mm-hmm. missions, 31 missions, 40 missions, whatever it was, and later falsified combat heroism records that he actually received. So there was in him, from the beginning, a kind of innate basic to distort. He would do anything to make a point. When he became a United States Senator, he defeated, this is a tragic story, I think, he defeated young Bob La Follette, who was the scion of the La Follettes of Wisconsin, people forgotten, but this was the heart of the progressive movement. They literally put the stamp of many of the progressive policies that both Theodore Roosevelt praised and admired, and Franklin Roosevelt adopted in the New Deal, came right out of Wisconsin, the test tube of democracy, Theodore Roosevelt called it at the time. And so the Follettes, McCarthy defeats La Follette in 46 very narrowly and becomes, at a time after World War II. And then he becomes a freshman senator. But he didn't do well. He was failing. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't connecting. His colleagues didn't like him. He would take them on, both Republicans and Democrats. He was a loose cannon. And he was losing favor in Wisconsin up until 1950, when he had 2 years to go before re-election. And he made a speech in Wheeling, West Virginia, to a Republican audience of 200 Republican women, the Republican Women's Club there, a Lincoln Day dinner, where the party sent out people, as they still do, their top speakers to talk about the extol Lincoln and then the theme of the year. The theme of the Republican campaign that year, 50, was that the Democrats were softening communism mm-hmm. and the government was infested with traitors. McCarthy gives a speech in Wheeling. He waves a sheaf of papers in his hands, and he says, I have here in my hand a list of 205 communists who are active members of a communist spy ring who are at this moment developing and shaping the policies of the United States through the State Department. Bang! That's where it started. Mm-hmm. He made this charge. There was no list. It was made up out of whole cloth. Totally untrue. And he then showed a kind of genius and the ability to manipulate the press. He would make a charge and then escalate the charge. And he would rise from the State Department and communist nests and spies. Then he starts escalating to Dean Acheson, the Secretary of State, to Harry Truman, mm-hmm. all the Democrats. And as he would go around, he'd make more charges. And what happened, the press would be manipulated, and they wouldn't really follow up. The headlines would catch the attention. And so he did this for 5 years. And he starts out from this lowering position in the Republican Party. All of a sudden, by 2 years, he was the single most powerful and feared political figure in America. And he's directly responsible, credited, with defeating 8 Democratic senators. Because he would go around the country and make the charges of communism, soft on communism, ignoble, godless atheist, and we can't have these subversives in the United States Senate, and they lost their seats. And all of a sudden, the Democrats said, as one said to another, after 52, he said, for whom does the bell toll? mm-hmm. it tolls for thee. Mm-hmm. And Republicans, who had disrespected McCarthy, didn't have much of a use for him, saw him as useful. Mm-hmm. He was gaining back the power and, in fact, contributed to Eisenhower's election in 52. Eisenhower would have won anyhow, but contributed powerfully. And then he started, the first Republican president since Herbert Hoover. So this new Republican era, fueled by fear of communism. And you know, Harry, it wouldn't have happened had there not been the surface material, mm-hmm. combustible material that McCarthy was able to stitch together about the communist threat, the atomic bomb, the nuclear holocaust, the fact that we might, and people who are young don't remember, if you were in grade school, you huddled under your desk for tests for atomic bomb security and civil defense structure.
And also the Rosenberg trial.
Yes, you had the idea of traitors. And McCarthy had just set out when he was wielding. Alger Hiss had just been convicted of perjury. Mm-hmm. They had arrested a spy named Claus Fuchs, who worked on the Manhattan Project developing the bomb. He did give secrets. Mm-hmm. Later on, the Rosenbergs were tried and executed. Mm-hmm. So this idea that we were losing the world fight with communism about to take us over, and that because our spies had betrayed mm-hmm. us, and then China had thrown away, Mao had won the war against mainland China over Chiang Kai-shek, and so you had an alliance between the Chinese and the Russians, and it was that the Berlin was a tender part. Everything was combustible, and Harry Truman was just about to announce the creation of the hydrogen bomb. So there was fear. Yeah. Fear. And legitimate reasons to be apprehensive. Fear after this victory in World War II. And McCarthy took it, rather than talk about what was the reality of the communist threat or how you combat it, he started making the charges that it was because of treason.
Mm-hmm. And it's important here to emphasize, not only was he lighting the matches to fuel yes. these fires, but he was also burning down our institutions, or attempting to. And so talk a little, maybe take a particular case, what his method was and the ways in which he violated people's civil rights.
That's what McCarthyism is in the dictionary today, for good reasons, because he put his name on and stamped on an era. It's making false charges, accusing people of disloyalty, no evidence, and falsely guilt by association and tactics. And McCarthy started attacking institutions of the United States, not just the government service. I think one of the most damaging things he did, he accused the government of being a nest of communists and traitors, and we're going to get rid of them. So the government service began cowering mm-hmm. and withdrawing, and many fine, talented people were either defamed or ruined or left in disgust of the government service. He attacked the press because the press was a left-wing lackey of Joe Stalin, and people who worked for the press, like me, I guess, were com-simps, as the phrase was at the time, or disloyal Americans. It was full of liberals, the word liberal that we hear today, another echo from past to present. They were all liberals. Educations. He took on education, people who'd speak out. You began to have a real sense of terror and conformity mm-hmm. throughout the United States, that if you subscribe to a certain progressive magazine or left-wing or read a certain book, you could be hauled in and put on a list of disloyalty. Mm-hmm. And so people withdrew and started thinking in. If I could tell you one episode to me that spells out for me how the terror of conformity afflicted. I was in graduate school at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which was, as you know, at that time, that was the Berkeley before Berkeley was mm-hmm. the center of protest and liberalism, the La Follette's progressive. And in 1952, Joe McCarthy, I was then in the Army, but Joe McCarthy made a speech, and he said that the University of Wisconsin had the greatest collection of communist literature, and they're allowing scholars to look at it and be shaped by it. And the university chancellor was asked, and when I was a graduate student, said, "Is it true?" And the chancellor said, "Yes, we intend to increase it." And I thought, right on. But that was a rare thing. Mm-hmm. And on July 4th, 52, it was so bad in Madison, Wisconsin, that a pollster went around in this liberal bastion, and he took 112 people, citizens of Madison, Wisconsin, and he said, I'm going to read you a series of quotations. I'm going to ask you if you would sign a petition saying you agree with these statements. And he read them. Every quotation was from the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. 111 out of 112 students, citizens of Madison, Wisconsin, the bulwark of liberalism and progressivism, did not, were afraid to sign that petition because they thought they'd be accused of subversion or communism. Mm-hmm. That's how bad it was.
Mm-hmm. And really, as you've already suggested, the Senate, over time, gave him free rein.
Yeah.
So he had a committee. He was chairman of a special Senate Operations Committee. He could hold witnesses before them and hold secret or not secret sessions and so on.
The power that he began to yield and yielded in almost unaccountable ways, because after he helped lead the Republicans to their new majority, he got the power to be a Senate chairman of investigating and double the size of staff and appointments, and he started devoting his entire energies to exposing, quote, communism in America, not just in the government, but in America, America institutions, hauling in writers.
Dennis.
Dennis, Pink Dennis, who had signed him. Maybe if you had signed a petition in 1932, if you were a young radical in the Depression, you could be put on a disloyal list, and he'd browbeat them, and he attacked them of subversion, and he expanded these hearings. There was a disgraceful, the hearing records of that time, most of the hearings, many of them were open and televised, but the great bulk were behind closed doors, closed. And those were classified, sealed for 50 years until I began writing this book, even as we were invading Iraq, and they had not been, and I'll tell you, if you read, and I did read all of this stack of the actual hearing, it is one of the most shameful. It is a witch hunt. It is Salem. It revisited in the United States in the 1950s. People were terrified, and he ruined lives. There was one suicide, and many people were fired from their jobs who just had nothing to do with communism, but they were seen as disloyal, therefore you didn't want them around. It was a witch hunt that went on. And literally for 5 years, Joe McCarthy's reign, more and more and more, and the arc went up in his power and his terror, and people were not willing the shame of that period. The moderates and distinguished people of goodwill on both sides, Republicans and Democrats, did not take him on. Mm-hmm. And he was fed by the anti-communist network.
Let's talk about individuals in a second who did stand up,
yes,
or at least one or another of them, and those who did not. But you've already mentioned this, but let's emphasize this, that really for the Republicans, it was about winning elections and having a new mandate after all the years of the new. But the Democrats ran scared here, and you point out that the Truman administration, in essence, in response to the first stirrings, instituted a security program to check on the loyalty of government employees.
Yes, they did, and the Truman administration embarked on the loyalty investigations and loyalty hearings, and really blacklisted people hauled in and questioned and fired and raised all kinds of questions, and that was the material that McCarthy could carry on and actually expand more. So it didn't all start with Joe McCarthy. Again, and the reason the Democrats were reacting that way is because they thought they would lose the 1948 election, which Harry Truman did win, and McCarthy, then the Republicans, and they had just won the Congress in 46. So by the time McCarthy grabbed this material, the Democrats saw him rising his power, and the Republicans did see him as a vehicle to gain power, and it worked, and the Democrats saw themselves eroding, and they thought they'd counter McCarthyism by their own loyalty investigation. So you had this whole climate. And by the time Joe McCarthy and Eisenhower and the Republican administration came, then he started turning his targets on the Eisenhower appointees. Mm-hmm. As disloyal. He wanted to be president.
Now let's look at particular individuals. The real, to use the famous phrase of President Kennedy, profile and courage.
Yes.
He, in this set of events, was not a profile in courage, correct? Because he was one of the people who, when we come to the end of the story, did not. But what was his calculation? Let's talk about a couple of these people.
Many of the portraits of the characters in the story, to me, are so fascinating. The Kennedy family, old Joe Kennedy, the patriarch, was very close to Joe McCarthy. He was anti-communist. He'd do anything he could. He'd raise money for McCarthy. He saw the communist conspiracy as a great threat to America. He took Joe McCarthy with him to Hyannisport and playing with the children and down to Florida. McCarthy dated one of the girls, Pat. Jack had been in the Pacific, and everything in old Joe's life was to make Jack President of the United States. And Jack was then, at that point, embarking on running for the Senate. That was the springboard, from the House of Representatives to the Senate. And he was running against a scion of Massachusetts, highly favored, Henry Cabot Lodge, who was then Eisenhower's campaign, national campaign manager. And McCarthy could have tipped the balance, and old Joe did not want McCarthy, a fellow Irish Catholic war veteran of World War II, to campaign against Jack Kennedy, Irish Catholic war hero in a state with a large Irish Catholic population. And even though McCarthy campaigned all over the country for other Republican candidates, he never entered Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. There are stories that I can't prove. His McCarthy staff believe that Kennedy gave him $100,000 or
$50,000. The old man.
The old man. Oh yeah. And so we don't know, but the fact we do know, the fact is that Jack Kennedy won his Senate seat in the springboard to the presidency. Eisenhower carried Massachusetts by 270,000 votes, and Kennedy won by 70,000. Mm-hmm. And Kennedy acknowledged later to Arthur Schlesinger that McCarthy, Schlesinger asked, "Why didn't you take on McCarthy when you two were in the Senate?" He said, "Hell, half of my constituents think he's a hero." Mm-hmm. And so that was, he stayed back. There was no profile in courage. And in fact, John Kennedy was the only senator not to be recorded when McCarthy eventually was censured by his colleagues.
Mm-hmm. Margaret Chase Smith from Maine, the true profile in courage.
Yes, she really was. And I, if there's anything, I hope people, if they reread what happened, she was a wonderful backbencher from Maine, a Republican, the only woman at that point ever to be elected to the Senate in our history, and not a conservative, not today's vote, but just proper prim and so forth, started out liking McCarthy, supporting him, but became very troubled the more she watched him. Guilt by association, hurling these false charges, dividing the country, using the Senate as a cloak of immunity to make these outrageous, and he did on the floor of the Senate, he would attack people of being communists and lackeys and so forth, and even fellow, and there was no way you could sue him for libel because they cloaked themselves from immunity from libel suits. And she watched and watched and saw this process and became more and more disturbed, and then crafted what is to me still the single greatest eloquent speech in my lifetime in Washington, D.C., and it was called the Declaration of Conscience. And it is signal profile and courage. She talked about the dangers of demagogues. She didn't use McCarthy's name. By fear and calumny and bigotry, mm-hmm. and dividing us and with hatred and using the cloak of the Senate to do all these things. She got six other colleagues to support her after she gave Republicans. And seven, rather. And so she gave this great, memorable, wonderful speech. You thought for a moment there might have been a change. And McCarthy just he sneered and dismissed it. And he said, "Oh, that's Margaret Chase. She's Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs." And within a period of weeks, literally weeks, sad to say, those other senators who had supported her dropped away, and they never challenged McCarthy. And she was alone. I mean, that to me is one of the tragic but noble moments in American history.
I'm going to show your book again, and it's a real page turner, and I want to recommend it very much to our audience. But there was a section that I want you to talk about here relating to the columnist Drew Pearson, because this was a, you know, like five or six pages on the confrontation between Pearson and McCarthy. Yeah. Pearson was a columnist who had gone after McCarthy for some of his corruption. They met at a party. And I must say, describe what happened, because the story reaches a new level here.
Yeah,
because this is not a demagogue or a politician. No. This is a man who crosses over on the edge.
This is a man vicious and brutal, capable of actual physical, terrifying assaults on other human beings. And he would boast about it afterwards. And this confrontation between Drew Pearson, the most popular then muckraker breaking columnist, I guess you would say, but also widely known for his radio broadcasts of the time. So, and he had been very critical of McCarthy, and they happened to meet at this private Soulgrave Club in Washington, D.C., off DuPont Circle. And McCarthy comes up to him and starts taunting him, says, Drew, I'm going to ruin you in the Senate. I'm going to give a speech on a cloak of immunity. I'm going to destroy you, and your wife will prove that you're a communist. And they come on and on and on. At one point, he keeps doing this during the dinner. At one point, he grabs over and puts his hand, McCarthy was very strong, behind Pearson's neck. And Pearson, this pain shot through him and so forth. And this was a horrible night. Finally, it was over. And Pearson goes down to the cloakroom to pay the hat check person for his coat. And all of a sudden, McCarthy comes up behind him, spins him around, and kicks him twice in the groin. Wham! Wham! And Pearson doubles over and says, this is what you're going to get, and so forth. At that point, Nixon, who was just a new senator, comes along and says, let a Quaker stop this fight. And McCarthy said, no, I'm not. And then McCarthy reaches over and slaps Pearson so hard that Nixon later described, I thought he was going to kill him. Mm-hmm. And then McCarthy goes out with Pearson, pretends that he's all right. He goes out into the, find their car, and they drive off. But McCarthy that night calls two people, one in Appleton, Wisconsin, a judge, Greta Van Susteren's father, as a matter of fact, Urban Van Susteren, and he calls the editor of the Washington Times Herald, a very conservative paper at the time, and boasts how I had kicked McCarthy in... McCarthy had kicked Drew Pearson in the groin. That's not the phrase he used.
Yeah.
And McCarthy boasted throughout his career that he learned how to fight in Wisconsin from an Indian Charlie, a member of an Indian tribe. He said, here's what you have to learn. He said, when you have an opponent, you start kicking him in the groin and keep kicking and kicking until there's nothing left in the groin until you win. And he boasted of this to his fellow senators in private hearings. I mean, that's the other side of Joe McCarthy. Absolutely brutal, monstrous. And he was a strong, very powerful man. That's what he was capable of.
When I read the scene, I thought of Alfred Hitchcock's Stranger on a Train,
yes,
where Bruno, the mad psychotic, actually attacks someone at a party and goes over the edge. And I wish I'd
remembered that, because that's exactly what it was. Mm-hmm. And that was the other side of McCarthy, that he could be very charming and gregarious and backslapping, and then he could turn on you instantly and he'd destroy you. Mm-hmm. And not only destroy you with attacks of disloyalty and communism, but physical assaults. Mm-hmm. So this was a very, very disturbed person and a dangerous person.
And in the end, he is brought down by his own actions and by his colleague, and he turns against the army, and which leads to the Army McCarthy hearings.
Right.
And so ultimately, but it took a long time for the institutions to term. And very important here is the role of television.
Yes.
These hearings were television. Talked about how journalism came to play such an important role.
At that point, looking back on it now, this was a television fine hour, because they actually, when you were able to see Joe McCarthy in the living rooms, and the Army McCarthy hearings were at that point the most widely watched event in the history of television to that point. And you saw day after day Joe McCarthy snarling, say, you're not fit to wear the uniform, attacking people, whispering, and brutally assaulting people. People were shocked, and he had valorous soldiers before him with medals and had bled in three wars and so forth, accusing them of communism and subversion, and the American people saw that, and that's what brought down Joe McCarthy. He imploded, and it happened in a wonderful, you talk about theater, the portrait, the protagonist, Joseph Welch, this mild-mannered, bow-tied lawyer, gentleman, decent, civil, from Boston, Halenville, but with a quiet little remark, and McCarthy finally attacked Joseph Welch, one of his partners, accused him of being a communist and trying to foist on the committee. Mm-hmm. It's not true, and Welch said at this point, have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last? Have you no sense of decency in there? And that quiet remark, with an older Joe Welch holding his hands in great sorrow, was engraved in the American memory. At that point, whatever Joe McCarthy had represented, he never recovered from that. And the censure hearings came right after those hearings.
It was in the latter part of McCarthy's reign of terror, I guess we can call it, that Edward Murrow did this special,
yes.
Which is now the subject of an excellent movie by George Clooney.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the Murrow hearings, see it now, was an eloquent, wonderful statement 1 month before the Armin McCarthy hearings, in which he actually challenged and said that the fault, dear Brutus, for McCarthy is not just in the stars, but it's in us, the American people, for allowing falsehood and shame and defamation to smear people and divert us from real questions before the country. I'm paraphrasing, but it was a wonderful half-hour documentary. Drew the largest response in television history for CBS, which at that time was the premier broadcast, and Ed Murrow was the most famous broadcast and respected journalist. It was a great moment. And the Clooney movie is wonderful because you see actually the picture of Joe McCarthy. They don't hire an actor. You see that sneering, blustering, bombastic, brutal person in action. But I told Clooney, I was happily with Clooney when the movie was premiered and we shared a podium together talking about my book and his movie, and I said what a wonderful movie it was, but you create a myth that it was Ed Murrow that brought him down. By then, 4 years had passed. 4 years had passed, and he was already then in the process of self-destruction and so forth. And he would have self-destructed had it not been, in any event. I think the movie is more important today because it's a reminder of what the press did not do today. Stand up, hold, be accountable, demand that our officials be accountable, shine bright lights in dark places, speak truth to power, whatever cliche, and that's what we didn't. We allowed ourselves to be manipulated on the war in Iraq. We again found ourselves used by the techniques of McCarthyism.
In one part of your book where you're placing the MacArthur period in the context of the history of the United States, you point out something very important which will allow us to segue into where we are today, and that is that this phenomena, McCarthy-like phenomena, has appeared in American history.
Yes.
And as I read over what you had to say, each time it seemed to be the result or the consequence of an external shock. The Alien Sedition Act,
that's right.
The French Revolution. Talk a little about these other examples before we talk about this period after 9/11.
Yeah, that's. I'm glad you said that because I was so struck by the repeated cycles of these things, and they are external dangers. The Alien Sedition Acts, the French Revolution, the fears that we're going to be beheaded in this country, in this alien, and people went to jail, they were hauled off and put in. It was a terrible time. And if editors wrote things in the paper, they were accused of sedition, and you could be thrown in jail, and people were. It was a very vicious period, and it was that outside threat.
Which was the French Revolution.
There were, people were accused of being disloyal and tainted with the French stamp. And then later, in the right after World War I, when the Soviet Union had come to power and the revolution had triumphed and Stalin and all that were in power, the same fear infested of that the communists were going to infiltrate and take over America and threaten our institutions. And the same kind of reaction, the spawning of fear of communism and the threat, even though the communism never had an anchor in this country. Never. There were minuscule numbers of people who were actually members of the party. I'm not suggesting that there were not problems with communism, we shouldn't be concerned, but the same kind of fear and the same kind of the investigations, people hauled into jail, put on with no charges and so forth, and then again during the McCarthy period, fear of the bomb, the external forces that created the idea the world might be extinguished, blown up, and therefore we had to combat ourselves against enemies, and now we have once again, terror, the terror strike. Well, terrorism's real. It's a real threat to us, but it can be the combustible material. It's outside, and it allows people to use that fear to gain and exploit and or retain political power, and that's the old continuing lesson.
And so, if we can summarize here about why this occurs again and again during certain periods in our history. It's about, it seems to be about winning elections in a democracy, and particular leaders seizing an opportunity to distort our national perceptions about how to address the problem. Is that
That's exactly the right definition. Yeah. I think you've said it better than I could.
Yeah.
That's so the conditions exist, and we are always going to have people who will try to exploit fear in winning elections. It ain't beanbag, as Mr. Dooley said. Politics is hard and fine, and should be. But the test of the democracy is for leaders and the press and the public to hold people accountable. Don't let them get away with it. Raise the question. If it's false, brand it as false. But document it. And instead, the fear allows itself, and for ignoble purposes, if you're winning an election, you can look away from the reality that you know is happening, and therefore it extends itself. That's what happened in McCarthy, and I'm afraid, I'd say, we've seen some of that in our own period right now.
And what you're suggesting in recounting the story and relating it to the present is really the fragility of our institutions, because if we look back to the McCarthy period and try to examine what's going on now, the extent to which we're seeing evidence that the press was compromised, and other institutions did not respond. And interestingly enough, with regard to some of our actions in Guantanamo and elsewhere, we discover that the military attorneys and judges and the Judge Advocates Corps protested some of the directions that we were taking with regard to the incarceration of people we were picking up both here and abroad.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the fact that these things happen in our time. I think the prison abuses is one of the most shameful chapters in American history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is simply, that's not what America is. You don't torture prisoners. Mm-hmm. You don't abuse them. You don't deprive them. You don't turn dogs on them. And we did that not only in Guantanamo and Alba Grave, but we also did it in our own domestic prisons in a sweep of people accused or suspected of maybe being disloyal because they were from Middle Eastern countries. They had done nothing wrong, and they're thrown into prisons, no charges. And sometimes there were beatings, and this is documented. I'm not making this up. And it was the system that failed. There were people who would speak up. The Attorney General of that time, Mr. Ashcroft, his own Justice Department, Inspector General, did a devastating analysis of what happened after 9/11 and these abuses, which was very much like the kind of abuses that occurred in the Alien Sedition Acts, in the period after World War I, and the Red Scare, and McCarthyism, and documented. And Ashcroft was asked about this, and he said, well, we do what we have to do.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. And it didn't get the coinage in the press because it happened. The investigation was released just as we were invading Iraq. And then all of a sudden, there's this thrust on the war in Iraq. And then the justification. Well, we have to do something to protect ourselves from these terrorists, even if we don't know they're terrorists, even if they're not charged with crimes, and even if they're beaten and brutalized, which is means American prisoners could be beaten and brutalized and if they're taken. So the whole, that's the danger. That's the danger. That's the danger that fear and political exploitation can create.
We're meeting on the very day and almost the very hour in which the special prosecutor has announced the indictment of Scooter Libby. And I wonder if, drawing on this study that you've done, what is it about that period when we turn, when we reach recognition that, hey, this isn't what about? Obviously, partly that's done by books like yours or George Clooney's movie, but really what becomes very important here is when the institutions of government and the political leaders turn, speak up, and so on. And what is it about that very important? I mean, what do you see that this history
tells
you?
Let me say, I believe, and I hope I'm not such a foolish optimist, but maybe I am, but I believe our history tells us. We have these repeated periods of repressions and fears and abuses of power and liberties, and they've gone throughout our history, we said, but then we always, the country, people do wake up and they see abuses that they find this is alien to our traditions and our best instincts for our own protection. Mm-hmm. And then you have a period of reform where you check the power, you check the abuses. On Watergate, you check the abuses. Or now in this case of the Scooter Libby case, of where you, it's really a McCarthyistic tactic. You leak information to the press with the purpose of discrediting or destroying or defaming a critic of your policies that take you to war. And you out, quote, the covert operative of his wife, which is against the law, although not charged in this criminal indictment today. But this is how you destroy enemies, and you do it surreptitiously. And if the press allows itself to be used, which it did, mm-hmm. to its great shame, it passed on these things without naming that the chief of staff of the vice president and others are naming to reporters all over, and they never tell you that. They never tell the public that. Now I think it's one of these turns. Things people understand. Iraq is not blooming with democracy. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a terrible, I think, one of the most colossal mistakes in our history. But anyhow, that's another story, but that's part of this background. And so you have this condition where people are now seeing all kinds of problems, the cronyism and the natural disasters, that we're not secure at home or abroad today as we thought we're supposed to be. We've seen how the government can manipulate information to retain power. I think we're at a moment where there's a hunger for a new kind of politics that holds people accountable. The special prosecutor, Mr. Fitzgerald, gave an eloquent statement as the defense, not braggadocio. This is what a good prosecutor does to protect the American citizens and to be fair to all parties. And you say, yes, that's the American system. And I have a feeling that could turn, that could create the kind of turn and demand for a better kind of accountability.
I wonder, do you think that in the present time we're living in right now that there have been institutional changes? For example, the mergers of the media, the poor quality of the information we get, even though there's more and more information. Yeah. The failure of the opposition political party right now, yeah. to actually enunciate an opposition. I'm just wondering, yeah. Does history tell us, oh, this has happened before and we can right ourselves, or have there been subtle changes that make that change more difficult?
Actually, the tactics and the kind of attacks that we see from McCarthy to now continue. It's much more difficult today for the reasons you're suggesting. The press, we have the 24-hour television. That is now the dominant factor in our lives. Television, the networks are declining in audience. These are rising. The talk radio we saw already had become. And so you have a sense of ideological food fights and attacks and distorting and not analyzing, not giving perspective, not giving authority. And then you have a cowering of the political system. The Democratic Party has been really cowed since McCarthy in some ways. I mean, it really, and not speaking up in the last election, John Kerry never defended himself from charges of smears and fears on the Swift Boat Fred's attack and his falsifying his war record and so forth. And the party itself was afraid to take on the national security elements of the president, who was running as the savior of the country. And I think it's much more complicated. But that doesn't mean that it means the test may be more critical, more difficult. But the need is greater for people to rise up independently and, again, demand accountability and by voting and turn out people that use these tactics. Mm-hmm. That's the only solution I see. The press itself, there's good reporting, but if you allow these things to go on without calling them to account. I heard Bill O'Reilly the other night on television, just two nights ago, talk about attacking the press for not giving the good news about Iraq. That the reason that all they talk about are the deaths and suicide bombs, and this is a deliberate left-wing part of the left-wing press, and he said, and I'm quoting him directly, it's treasonous. Mm-hmm. And I thought, where have I heard that before? Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of thing. And a large audience, and there'll be people who will believe that unless you have counter So we need to be much more vigilant. Democracy is an experiment. No one guaranteed it was going to work. We got a lot of work to do.
I'm curious because you were an editor, you've been a reporter for the Washington Post, and you've been in the Washington setting. Is the compromising of reporters that we're seeing from the New York Times especially, is that just one or two rotten apples, do you think? I mean, is it that they've crossed over because of the milieu in which you do get information? You know, it's part of the way Washington works. Or is it more systemic, do you think?
It's more systemic, and it's and I don't want to defame my colleagues. I mean, there are good examples of a good journalist. You do want to protect your sources, absolutely. And you should be willing to go to jail if the source is giving you material that is in the public interest to expose wrongdoing. Mm-hmm. The whistleblower, that's whom you protect. And you protect them because they could lose their jobs or even their lives. And that's how you protect. You don't protect someone that comes to you like Scooter Libby and lies to you and outs people. And then you allow yourself to present that material to the public. I think that is more endemic today. And for a lot of reasons. There, the press is, the attacks of the press of being liberal have had a toll, I think, on this part. And I also think the corporatization, I don't want to get into the sort of a demonization, but there's a bottom line. You want entertainment, you want shock, you want conflict. They want to mix it up. That's what they want, and they want more profits, and that's what sells. So I think there are a lot of factors involved.
One final question. What advice would you give to students as they prepare for their future so that they can be part of the solution and not part of the problem, whether in journalism or in other institutions?
Participate. Be informed. You can be informed in the society, even despite the problems we're talking about. There's an enormous amount of serious information. It's hard work. It's in your interest, not because it's noble, not because democracy is the only possible answer, but because it's in your self-interest for your life and your security and your future. And then be willing to stand up and be counted. And don't be silent, don't be quiescent, wherever you are. If you're in the press, if you're a public citizen, wherever you are, if you're a prosecutor, you do the job that the society really requires you to do, and don't be afraid to do it, and then, okay, we'll be all right, I think.
Well, Haynes, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being here, and I want to show again your book, which is, thank you for writing it. It's a timely account whose timing is even more perfect than one could have anticipated.
Too much so.
Yeah. Thank you very much again for joining us
today.
Thanks,
Harry.
Thank you.
Very enjoyable. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.